Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 33 of Season 8 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we FUBAR our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Hal Bryan of the Rocketeer Minute. Welcome back to the show, Hal.
Well, thanks for having me back, Rob. Great film to be talking about.
Yeah. And I'm sure that everyone's been anticipating the little teaser that we left yesterday. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yes, indeed.
So minute 33 begins with a car approaching and ends with a colonel giving his assessment. So basically we ended things yesterday by looking out at, from Mrs. Ryan's perspective, of where there's a car starting to come up towards the farmhouse and trying to figure out, who knows, where is it? what are they coming to tell her?
Right.
Is it good news? Is it bad news? Who knows? We shall have to wait and see. So at this point, the car, as it's coming closer, she opens up the screen door and walks outside. And as the car turns to park, I guess you can say, at that point, you can clearly see, and she probably clearly sees at this point, that it has a U.S. Army star on the side of the car. And as she's looking at it, an officer comes out, followed by a minister, pastor, some sort of priest, some sort of clergyman, who both of these men start taking off. They both take off their hats, and as they take off their hats, she just collapses to the ground. She takes a few steps backwards and just falls to her knees. She does a nice job of catching herself.
And she obviously doesn't fully react until she sees that there's a chaplain. In the car. If it was just the officer, he could be coming to say anything. I mean, sorry, there was a mix-up with one of your son's pay, and the back checks are coming. I mean, it could be any sort of logistical thing. Not very likely, but I think there was still there could have been that holdout hope in her mind of good news. But once you see the chaplain, then she knows it's not good. I, again, still can't possibly imagine how not good, but... Yeah, there she is.
Correct. Now, I find it very interesting the fact that they both take off their hats. So do you know about hat etiquette?
Not a great deal. I know that for the U.S. Armed Services, it is basically strictly forbidden to be outside uncovered, or really to ever be uncovered. If you're under a roof, then you take your hat off because your head is covered. When you're outside, your hat remains on. I don't think anybody would fault this guy for, obviously in this case, they are both doffing their hats as a gesture of respect to the woman. And I don't think anybody would fault him, the officer, for doing that. But I don't know if that would technically be correct in terms of protocol.
Okay. So I wasn't even talking about from a military perspective, because obviously the chaplain is not is probably not military, because otherwise he would have been in uniform also at the time with the whole thing. But so in when is it respectful to remove a hat? In what type of situations?
Historically, we certainly haven't seen this in this country in decades, but I mean, historically, you would at least tip your hat to a lady, if not full on remove it. And certainly when paying respects, as in this case, to someone who has lost a loved one, or you're paying respects to the dead, you would remove your hat. And then, of course, I was talking more of the military side of it, but etiquette-wise, one should never wear a hat indoors, even though that's not really a rule anymore in our society.
Right. Okay. So first of all, whenever you hear the national anthem being performed, it's a sign of respect to take off your hat. The gesture shows that you honor your country, its history, and those who have served and have been in active service. When people are in places of worship, they usually will take off their hats. This act acknowledges the sacredness of the space and its custom, showing deference to the religious practices and beliefs observed within. It also reflects an understanding that the places are hallowed grounds where worshipers come to engage in solemn and often profound spiritual activities. By removing your hat, you're not only adhering to long-established etiquette, but also participating in a collective expression of humility and honor towards the divine and the sanctity of the environment. And then you have formal events. So you have weddings, funerals, and other significant ceremonies often require the removal of hats. This act signifies respect for the event, the individuals involved, and the transition that that accompany such important occasions. Removing your hat during the ceremonies acknowledges the significance of the moment, ensuring that you honor the feelings and customs of all attendees. It also shows that you understand and adhere to the social norms that help maintain decorum and reverence during pivotal life events, creating a respectful and unified atmosphere for everyone present. So I think that this situation fits into that third category. You know, that it's the idea. Cause but if you see like in movies, and I'm assuming that you've also been to military funerals, people don't take off their hats in military funerals. It's the exact opposite. Everyone's wearing their hat.
Right. If they're outside and if there's an occasion to be called to attention or to salute, it would normally be appropriate to be wearing the hat. And you would, if you're outside and you take off your hat, yeah, that you would technically be out of uniform at that point. But I have to qualify this and say I don't claim any specific expertise. Just 2 years long ago, spent in Air Force ROTC and learning a little bit. In my days in uniform in law enforcement, we almost never wore hats. And when we did, the etiquette around it was a bit, I don't want to say looser. It was just a bit less well-defined.
Okay. That's fair. That's fair. I mean, one of the things it also says here, and we can see that he does this, is that in the military, removing hats indoors is a tradition that signifies respect for the institution and its customs, and also shows respect for others. The military is obliged to wear their hat under their arms when taking your hat off. So he does that. He takes his, the pastor or the clergyman doesn't do that. He's still holding his hat in his hand. But the officer, you see that when he takes off his hat, he puts it under his arm.
Right.
So,
and I mean, that would be a very reflexive action for him.
Right. Yeah. And I like the way that they have that. It works well.
Yes.
And so obviously they move closer to her in order to comfort her. And the pastor takes her wrist as the captain that's there gets ready to sit. It looks like he's about to sit down on the on the stoop, the steps as he's getting closer to her or anything like that. But again, I love the way that they maintain the shot throughout, that it's a split shot. You know what we discussed yesterday, how the right hand side shows the brothers and the left hand side shows the mother being comforted by this officer and this clergyman. I mean, you can also still see that there's someone else in the car. You know, the driver didn't get out.
Right.
It's not as important for him to get out,
Right. I mean, the driver could be a lower level enlisted guy. This officer is a captain, I believe. I think we see that when he gets a little bit closer. And
right.
Yeah. And it was an interesting choice too. Sort of stepping back for a minute, we know why they're there to deliver this horrible news, and it was an interesting choice to sort of spare us having to hear that news again ourselves and having to watch her react to it. It was, I think, a nice and a respectful choice to not have dialogue around her and, you know, them telling her this news and her sort of emotionally losing it and wailing and things. It's, we know what happened and we can leave her in her grief and kind of move on with the story from there.
Yeah. And it's great the way that they do that. And, you know, as quickly as we came to this scene, you know, a minute and a half ago, 2 days ago, it just changes again, but it's a nice, it's a nice way to transition. You know, we talked about this a little bit on Monday. I mean, we had the whole beach stuff, then there's the transition to the clerks, then there's a transition here, and then now we're back in another setting.
Right.
We're back with we see a general in front of us, played by Harv Presnell. You familiar with him from anywhere?
I was trying to think about that, and I actually ran through his IMDb credits not too long ago because he looks really familiar. And I don't know, he's been in stuff I've seen, but I don't know that I specifically would have remembered him from. Like, he was in something like Evan Almighty. I know he was in Andy Richter's short-lived Private Investigator series. But I don't recall there being, you know, that one thing that jumped out and say, oh, that's why I recognize him. He looks like he's one of these solid, perhaps tends to be more of a character actor. And kind of plugs away at things. I think he was also in an episode of From the Earth to the Moon?
That's a very good question.
I think he was. And then glancing at my notes, the one thing that I might have recognized him from was he was Lois Lane's dad in Lois and Clark, the Terry Hatcher, Dean Cain, Superman and Lois Lane series that I thought was a lot of fun. So he might have been familiar to me from that, but I don't think I ever would have made that connection without the magic of IMDb.
Okay. No, that's fair. So first of all, you are correct. He was in an episode of From the Earth to the Moon. He was in the second to last episode for Miles and Miles.
Okay.
But it doesn't state here who he played. So I don't recall... which again is a little strange for IMDb that they're not that they usually give us all the information and here they don't. So it's but why is For Miles and Miles? I thought For Miles and Miles was the one with the golf episode. It's the one. It's the one about Alan Shepard. Yeah, it is the one about Alan Shepard. Ah, now I know why I'm getting confused, because there are 12 episodes, not the second to last episode. So it's episode 9. Okay, that makes sense. But it doesn't state who he plays. So, damn, now you've made me have to go back and rewatch From the Earth to the Moon. Not that that's a bad thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just time-consuming.
That's a terrific. Yeah, time-consuming. If there's only more hours in the day, such a fantastic series. It's been a few years since we watched it, and prior to that, it had been quite many years. But you forget how just wonderfully good it is.
Yeah, no, I don't remember who he plays in this. Wow, that's going to really bug me for a while. That's not good. But the character that he has played – that has always stuck out to me more than any other performance that he has had was his role in Fargo.
You know, Fargo is one of those movies that just I have yet to see. I'm aware of it.
All right. And, well, you know, thank you for joining me this week, pal.
That's the end of that, huh? Kind of figured this one. I know it's very odd. There was these weird standout films that, you know, boy, Hal, you really, really love movies. You're into these things. Of course you've seen X, Y, and Z. It was when we're talking Tom Hanks, I will also confess, and then you can just pull the plug and never speak to me again. But it was only maybe 5 to 7 years ago that I finally saw Forrest Gump.
Okay.
But and I'm not sure how that... How that sort of things happens. And it's like Fargo is out there. It's on the list. I hear these wonderful things about it. I can tell when somebody is making a reference to it. But just haven't gotten to it yet. But I will watch Fargo before I go back and rewatch, say, all of Bosom Buddies. I can promise you that. How's okay. that?
That is completely fair. Completely fair. So I found that he plays a character named Harv, which again doesn't help me to understand what character he plays in From the Earth to the Moon. This is going to be very frustrating. So if anyone out there, maybe Jim's listening, and maybe Jim will say, "Oh well, of course, this is the guy he plays." You know, so you know, maybe he was like the doctor who helped Alan Shepard or something like that.
Sure.
It's probably something that simple, you know, that you wouldn't expect it to be so simple. But oh well, that's the way it is. So right, so he plays General George C. Marshall, the Army Chief of Staff during this time of World War II. Now, do you know anything about him?
About George Marshall?
Yeah.
In real life, not particularly. I mean, we know. In my mind, he's probably best known for his you know post-war efforts as part of the Marshall Plan, but I can't really speak to any aspect of his career with any authority.
Right. Okay. So I mean, he was the chief of staff of the Army from 1939 to 1945, and then he became the Secretary of State in 1947. He was Truman gave him the job as Secretary of State. And his deputy was Dean Acheson, who ended up becoming the next Secretary of State after him. He was only Secretary of State from 47 to 49. And then in 1950, he became the Secretary of Defense, also for Truman, from 50 to 51. And, you know, there as you said, he's largely known for the idea of the Marshall Plan. You know, here he's the main... the head of the army, you know, that you know, this type of thing, this question about what we're doing with this, you know, this problem with the Ryans goes all the way to the top, which is, again, it's an amazing idea that something goes from a quote unquote low level clerk and within a very short amount of time, obviously we don't know how long it takes, but, you know, it goes all the way up to the chief of staff.
Right. And I think, I think the only one that would have directly outranked Marshall at this point would have been Eisenhower. Here's Marshall with 4 stars and Ike had 5, I believe, by this point.
Wait, so if he was the supreme Allied commander, would be higher ranked than the chief of staff?
Maybe.
Again, I don't know.
It's, you know, I'd have to look it up. But I mean, Eisenhower was one of the handful of 5-star generals. I don't know for certain that he had his 5th star at this point. So Marshall at this point is a 4-star. And I'm embarrassed. I should probably just know that. But it was easily rectified with a moment on Google.
Right. I mean, I know that he did become a 5-star general. So the question is, is he a 5-star general at this point or not? You know, that's the question. Wait, so he's the chief of staff of the army, but then you have...
So I just cheated, Rob.
Okay.
And,
it's not cheating.
In large part because of his efforts on D-Day. He was promoted. Eisenhower was promoted that following December, and became was appointed general of the army. So he would have, at least on paper, been a peer of Marshall at this point. Both of them being 4-stars, but in terms of their specific responsibility, I'm not sure where supreme commander sounds like you're pretty much at the top with Eisenhower, and chief of staff. You know, seems like it might be just one half a notch below that, but rank wise, they certainly looks like they would have been the same rank at this point in history.
It's very possible. That I don't know when he got his 5th star.
Eisenhower got his 5th star in December.
Eisenhower. I'm talking about Marshall, because Marshall got a fifth star also.
Oh, sorry, Marshall did get a 5th star. Okay. So let me see. He's only got the 4, but yeah.
Right. they were actually going to make him Supreme Commander of Operation Overlord. But then he would have to leave his position as the chief of staff of the army. So Roosevelt decided to give it to Eisenhower because he wanted Marshall to stay in chief of staff position. He's in famously, Roosevelt said to Marshall, "I don't feel like I'd sleep at ease if you were out of Washington."
There you go.
Right. So on December 16th, 1944, Marshall became the first American general to be promoted to the newly created rank of General of the Army, a five-star rank that placed senior American commanders on an equal footing with the field marshals of European allies. Marshall had objected to being awarded the title of Field Marshal, as it would have given him the title of Marshal, which sounds like something out of Airplane, you know?
Right, it does, yes. That's interesting. And then it looks like Eisenhower got his just a few days later.
Right. So at that point, they were both five-star generals. How many chief of staffs of the Army do you think there have been since the position was created in 1903?
Wow. I have no idea, but I am going to guess 15.
41.
See, not even close.
Do you know who the current Army Chief of Staff is?
That I do not know. The current Army Chief of Staff, I don't.
General Randy George, since September 21st,
2023. Okay. Well, I do these things to learn things, and I just learned some more.
That's right. So he's been the chief of staff for a little over a year at this point. The conversation continues between the generals, and Marshall starts off by saying, "God damn it." And then Bryce says to him, "All four of them were in the same company in the 29th Division, but we split them up after the Sullivan brothers died on the Juno." Right. So this is the point I wanted to discuss with you based on our conversation yesterday with that little teaser.
Isn't that interesting?
According to this, they were together. They were in the same company. You know, if Ryan says this was the last time that they were all together, if they're in the same company, it means they weren't necessarily in the same units. You know, there were different platoons or whatever it is, but you know, they might have been able to get around to taking a picture of all four of them together.
Sure.
But yeah,
the odds would have been overwhelmingly good that they would have been together. So I think this is just a little continuity discrepancy. You know,
maybe Jimmy Ryan had a little shell shock later on when he's telling his story and didn't remember that he had actually seen his brothers afterwards.
Exactly.
You know, that would probably be the best explanation for the whole thing.
Right. Yeah. Short of just shrugging and saying the writers made a mistake, but
how would writers make a mistake? Is that possible?
I don't know. It's impossible. I mean, I write for a living, and I've certainly never made one.
No, of course not.
I've never made more than one mistake, maybe per word.
Okay, there you go. Very true. So he basically says that they split them up after the Sullivan brothers died on the Juno. Now, do you have any idea do you know what that story is?
I don't know the details of the story. I do know it is factual
that yes.
The Juno was a Navy ship, but I don't know the circumstances beyond that.
Okay, so the Sullivan brothers were five brothers from Waterloo, Iowa, who served together on the light cruiser Juno, and they were all killed together during the Battle of Guadalcanal on November 13th, 1942. The Juno was crippled by a torpedo fired by a Japanese destroyer, and then there was another torpedo shot from a submarine, basically that sunk the ship. Surprisingly, they actually found the wreckage of the Juno in 2018.
Wow.
Yeah. And so the five brothers were the sons of Thomas and Alida Sullivan. You have George, who was 27 at the time, Frank, who was 26, Joe, who was 24, Matt, who was 23, and Al, who was 20. And all five of them were serving together. They had a sister also, Genevieve, who lived to 1975. She was actually part of the WAVES, you know, the Women's Auxiliary Unit.
And, oh, sure.
Yeah. And what happened was that she was the girlfriend of a guy named Bill Ball, who was on the Arizona and on Pearl Harbor. And she was able to, I guess, convince all of her brothers to join the Navy to go avenge him. Al was married. Actually, that's interesting. The youngest one was married. And he had a son named Jimmy. Joe was engaged, as was Matt. And the son of Al Sullivan, so Jimmy Sullivan, served on board the USS the Sullivans, which was a ship that they christened in the name of the death of the five of them. So that's pretty interesting.
That is amazing. Yeah, I wasn't aware that there was a USS Sullivan after the fact. That's remarkable. That's an honor.
They were known as the Fighting Sullivan Brothers, and they became national heroes. Roosevelt sent a letter of condolence to the parents. Pope Pius XII sent a silver religious medal and rosary with his message of regret. The Iowa Senate and House adopted a formal resolution of tribute to the Sullivan Brothers. There is a school named after them, which is in Japan, which is very weird. It's a DOD dependent school in Japan that's named after them.
Wow.
There is a they renamed the convention center in Waterloo, Iowa, in 1988 as the Five Sullivan Brothers Convention Center. Oh, so there are two destroyers named after them. Okay, they're actually both known as the USS the Sullivans. They just have different, number designations. It was the first American ship to be named after more than one person. And the motto of both of these ships was, we stick together.
Wow, that's powerful.
Yeah, and they have a Sullivans Association, which is an organization of veterans who served on both U.S. Navy ships named after the brothers, and they've had reunions. And in 2011, they had the reunion in Waterloo, Iowa, and they gathered at Sullivan's Park and visited the cemetery and laid flowers in the graves of the brothers.
Gosh,
yeah. There was a movie that was. That tells their story, known as The Sullivans, which came out in 1944. Obviously, this movie mentions them. There's a song called Sullivan by the alternative rock band Caroline Spine, which tells the story of The Sullivans.
Huh.
The Juno was a ship that was commissioned in 1942. And it was sunk just a few months later with the whole thing. It was an Atlanta-class light cruiser. There were 687 officers and sailors on board that were killed in action as when it was sunk. There were only 10 survivors that were rescued after 8 days in the water.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
Powerful stuff.
Yep. Really is. At this point, Marshall then asks the question, any contact with the fourth son, James? And he goes, no, sir. He was dropped about 15 miles inland near Newville, but that's still deep behind German lines. And then there's another officer who we have yet to meet who's standing next to Marshall. And you can see that it's a famous movie officer played by Dale Dye.
Yep. And Dale Dye is one of those, he's kind of been a personal Easter egg for me for I don't know how many decades. And one of those guys that once you recognize him, You know, he was the real deal, did multiple tours in Vietnam and had a distinguished military career before starting as a military technical advisor in films and then eventually getting small roles in so many movies. And it's just for me, there's something reassuring when he shows up because he's got the bona fides to be a good advisor. And it's always fun just to spot him on screen. It's like, oh, there he is.
Yeah, and I always love seeing Dale die in the movies. In movies, I mean, his first big movie that he was in was Platoon,
right?
You know, where he plays the commander who really, you know, gives his officers hell, explaining to them why they need to do, you know, he says, and you will fight. That means you, Lieutenant Wolf. Yeah. So I always love that. But yeah, and I mean, Dale Dye made a career out of this whole thing just by, you know, creating a boot camp, and so many different famous movies have, you know, used his boot camp in order to get all of the actors in shape and in the right mind frame of, you know, of dealing with this type of stuff. So yeah, it's always fun, you know, seeing him show up. You're 100% right. Now, there's no place where in the movie it says what his name is. And so the, you know, even in the credits, he's just known as a War Department colonel. So in the novelization that they did of this movie, so he's known as Colonel Dye. But I don't know how much I actually want to give that, give credence to that, because the names of the other two characters that we've talked about recently, you know, the colonel and the captain, they have different names in the novelization also. The colonel's name is Wilson, as opposed to Bryce. So he pipes up and says, now, Mac, there's no way you can know where in the hell he was dropped. So, first of all, why is he calling Bryce Mac?
That's a good question.
I don't know. And then he continues, and he turns to Marshall, and he goes, General, first reports out of Ike's people at Chef said the 101st has scattered all the hell and gone. There's misdrops all over Normandy. Now, assuming Private Ryan even survived the jump. And then he gets cut off. Now, he mentioned Chef, or Shafe. Do you have any idea what that is? It's an acronym.
Is it the Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force?
It definitely is.
Well, then, gold star for me for the
day.
Maybe not.
Exactly. We're not giving out gold stars. Poor choice of words.
Very poor choice of words. A plus for me today. Oh, goodness.
Ouch. Exactly. So, yeah. that's pretty much how this minute ends, mid-sentence for Colonel Dye. You know, he doesn't have much to, you know, we'll have to wait tomorrow to figure out what it is that he's trying to say here.
Right.
All right, so every Wednesday we have a segment called World War II Wednesday, where my guest will give their top five World War II movies. So, once again, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay. This was, in ways, in some ways, this was another tough one, mainly just because it was tough restricting it to five. But by the time I get to, say, the top three, that part was pretty easy. But I went with, for number five, one that a lot of people haven't seen. It's one of Russell Crowe's very first major motion pictures, maybe the first Canadian film, called For the Moment. And it takes place in Manitoba during World War II and offers insights into the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan, which is an area of history that I have a specific interest in. And that is, I have a lot of time flying airplanes that were used in that. And as we're recording this, I'm in the process of buying one, an airplane that was served in the RCAF in the 1940s as part of the plan. So anything that shows little slices of life during that particular era, and that kind of lesser seen part of the war effort during World War II. And that takes me right to number four, which is another film that touches a lot on the BC-ATP. It's a lot about bush flying at first and then transitions to the training plan, and that's called Captains of the Clouds. And that was a Jimmy Cagney picture, and I believe it was Cagney's first color picture, perhaps even Technicolor. Then in the number three spot, I've got a Czech film called If I'm Even Coming Close to Pronouncing It Correctly, and apologies if I'm butchering it, but at least I'm giving it a try, called Tmavo Madri Svet. And in English, that's called Dark Blue World. And that's about Czech pilots flying in the RAF during World War II. Number two is Tora, 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 just one of those great grand spectacle films of the 70s that we don't see anymore. When you know, a dozen or more airplanes were specifically constructed and modified for this film to really recreate the attack on Pearl Harbor, and the film. You know, no film is perfect, but this one, in so many ways, just sort of plays out almost almost like a documentary. Hands down, unquestionably in the top spot for me is the 1969's The Battle of Britain. Unprecedented, never seen before or since, assemblage of aircraft. For a film, I mean, you know, not since, you know, Howard Hughes and Dawn Patrol and Hell's Angels and that era. I mean, did you ever see anywhere near this many aircraft on screen at once? And just an absolutely glorious, just magnificent film. My honorable mentions, which I know you don't say are in the rules, but hey, I'm the guest. I get break the rules a little bit, would be A Yank in the RAF. And then I've got two mini series on the list, which I know really don't count. One of them is called Piece of Cake, a BBC miniseries about RAF fighter pilots. And you probably connect seeing a theme there, a lot of RAF and fighter pilot stuff. RAF fighter pilots during sort of the phony war and then the early days of the Battle of Britain. And then two epic 80s miniseries called The Winds of War and War in Remembrance. And I enjoy those miniseries quite a bit, but I mainly enjoy them because I love those two books so much. Two books written by Herman Woke that takes a fictional family that's just big enough and just sort of geographically diverse enough to take us through the whole history of World War II from start to finish. We follow the fictional Henry family all over the world. And the miniseries, I think the casting is very good. It very much has sort of 80s miniseries production values and certainly feels a bit dated now. But enjoy the miniseries because it brings to life two books that I love. Yeah, so much.
I'm a big fan of The Winds of War also. I used to be a big fan of Jan Michael Vincent, who was in it. Due to all the problems that he caused them during production, they didn't invite him back for War in Remembrance. I've seen War in Remembrance, and I've been meaning to rewatch it. Again, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier this week about time. That's what time. It comes down to. War in Remembrance is something that I do want to find time to rewatch one of these days, just to think it in once again.
And for me, it's one of those things. I mean, it's hard for me to even sort of judge it objectively. Like, I can't sit here and tell you, Rob, oh my gosh, it's fantastic. It really holds up. Or, you know, oh, it's really dated and it's a big letdown from the first ones. I don't even really know, because in my mind, it's just, as I'm watching these, I'm just reliving the story from the books in a new and different way. And, you know, in the books hold a very special spot for me and in my reading. And in fact, reading those books as a young teenager, if not even a little bit younger than that, really gave me the framework to really sort of understand and put World War II in context. And it seems silly. It's just, you know, it's fiction and whatever else, but Woke was such a good researcher and put so much depth in his writing that even now, when I think about particular campaigns in World War II, sometimes it's easy to picture some member of the Henry family and, okay, that's right, that's when Byron was here in Lisbon, or that's when, you know, his brother was flying the Dauntless over in the Pacific and this kind of thing. I should be embarrassed by that, but it did me a great service. It gave me a terrific grounding and understanding of the broad timeline of the war when I was still pretty young. And I think everything I've studied and learned since then has helped flesh that out and kind of plug into it.
Right. Okay. Makes sense. Great list. Thank you very much for that. So Al, would you like to once again tell people where they can find you?
Sure. You can hear me and my dear friend and co-host Jim O'Kane on both the Rocketeer Minute and October Sky Minute. You can find those rocketeerminute.com, octoberskyminute.com, or on iTunes, Google Play, Amazon, Audible. You can even find the episode listings on IMDb if you want to prowl through and see who our guests are. Otherwise, you can also hear me from time to time on the Green Dot, the Experimental Aircraft Association's aviation podcast. If you're an EAA member, which I'm curious if anybody out there listening happens to be, you can certainly read my work in Sport Aviation Magazine every month, whether it's the stuff that I write or the stuff that I edit as one of the leads of the team that puts that all together. And on social media, all the major ones, you just find me at Hal Bryan and you send me a message, send me a friend request, say hello. I'd love to hear from anybody.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on my website, movearoundminute.com. You can send me an email to movearoundminute@movearound.net. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Facebook and you can find me on Twitter. So until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this.
Solitude.